Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Iraqi forces have launched an operation to retake the western province of Anbar from Islamic State militants. The announcement on state television is less than 2 weeks after ISIL fighters seized Ramadi, the provincial capital. Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has expressed confidence that Ramadi will be retaken in days. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden telephoned Mr. Abadi to reaffirm American support in the effort after U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter publicly doubted the will of Iraqi troops who, in spite of greater numbers than the IS, fled from Ramadi when the fighters moved in. Kenyan officials say al-Shabaab militants attacked police Monday in the northeast portion of the country near the border with Somalia. As Gabe Joslow reports, one officer was killed by the Islamist-linked group.
Kenyan police officials say one police officer was killed and at least four others were injured when suspected al-Shabaab gunmen attacked a police patrol in the areas of Fafi and Yumbis in Garissa County. Interior Ministry spokesman Mwenda Njoka told VOA the attack began when a police vehicle hit a landmine.
So some other officers came to rescue. The border vehicle and the officers were there. There was an ambush by the militants.
In the same county last month, the Islamist militants killed 148 people, mostly students, in a day-long assault on a local university. Al-Shabaab claimed to have killed more than 20 police officers in the attack, as reported by local media. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Russian military began a new round of exercises today, coinciding with NATO's military maneuvers in the Arctic at a time of escalating tensions between the two sides. 700 units of military equipment, 12,000 Russian troops, and up to 250 military jets are involved in their Air Force drill, which began Monday, the same day that fighter jets from the U.S. and eight European nation countries began Arctic Challenge Exercise 2015. This is VOA News. The espionage trial of Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian began Tuesday in Iran with proceedings closed to the public. The state-run IRNA news agency said the trial is being held in a revolutionary court, which typically hears cases involving national security. Rezaian was arrested last July and held for months in Iran's notorious Evin prison without charges or being allowed to visit with a lawyer. He has since been allowed one brief meeting with a lawyer and has been charged with spying and propaganda. His brother Ali says authorities are holding the trial behind closed doors, not for security reasons, but because they know they have no evidence. The U.S. is conducting surveillance flights to help locate migrants abandoned by people smugglers in Southeast Asia. The U.S. Embassy in Bangkok told VOA's Steve Herman today that the maritime surveillance flights began Sunday off the west coast of Malaysia. The embassy did not provide any further details on the flights except to say they commenced after consultation with governments in the region. Southeast Asian governments have been reluctant to help migrants, viewing them as illegal migrants and turning them away from their shores. A heat wave in India has left more than 500 people dead, and forecasters expect punishing conditions to persist in the coming days. Most of the deaths have been in the southern states of Andhra Pradesh and Telangana, where the Indian Meteorological Department predicts high temperatures will exceed 400 degrees Celsius through at least the end of the month. The heat wave has produced some daily temperatures as high as 48 degrees Celsius in the past week. South Korea is demanding Japan acknowledge forcing Koreans to labor at sites that Tokyo wants added to the list of UNESCO World Heritage Sites. VOA's Brian Padden reports on the latest development in this dispute over Japan's wartime atrocities.
Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yoshihide Suga, said the UNESCO-nominated site should be considered separate from the ongoing regional dispute over the atrocities committed during Japan's military occupation of Asia in the first half of the 20th century. Suga says they should not politicize this issue. South Korean and Chinese officials have voiced opposition to seven of these sites, where some 60,000 laborers from Korea and China were reportedly forced to work long hours and under dangerous conditions. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Malaysian authorities have denied entry to Hong Kong student activist Joshua Wong, one of the main organizers of last year's pro-democracy protests that riled Beijing. Wong posted on his Facebook page today that a Malaysian immigration official denied him entry because of a government order. The 18-year-old activist did not elaborate. Malaysian customs officials have not commented on the incident, which is reported to have happened on the northern Malaysian island of Penang. Wong was scheduled to speak at a series of seminars on the government's crackdown at Tiananmen. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The total as of today is 27,001 cases of Ebola reported.
That's World Health Organization Assistant Director General Bruce Aylward with the latest on Ebola. Details coming up. Also in the news, UNICEF says Boko Haram militants increasingly are using women and girls as suicide bombers of choice. And gunmen attack UN peacekeepers in Mali, killing one. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the World Health Organization gave an update today on the West Africa Ebola outbreak. It says the number of overall cases has reached a new milestone. Dr. Bruce Aylward is the World Health Organization's Assistant Director General for Emergencies.
First of all, in terms of the Ebola epidemic, it is not finished. The job is not done, and you know that. And I think there was a new statistic as of today that highlights, again, the job is not done. And that is because that inexorable increase in cases has continued to pass new thresholds. And today, we've just gone over 27,000 cases, reported cases. So the total as of today is 27,001 cases of Ebola reported.
The latest figures are for the reporting period that ended Sunday.
So in this past week, we had 12 cases reported total. We had that upsurge in cases 2 weeks ago with 36 cases, an alarming development for many. And then this week, the cases have come down again to 12, but not quite to where they were 3 weeks ago when they were at 9. Just the week prior, they were at 18. So if you have the numbers for the last 4 weeks, it's been 18, 9, 36, 12, which is, if anything, a stark reminder of the fact that it is a very bumpy road getting to zero with Ebola.
He says 9 of the cases were in Guinea and 3 in Sierra Leone.
Over the past month, we've been dealing with 6 or fewer districts and prefectures with active transmission for a whole month now, and that's the lowest number of infected areas that we've been dealing with for a full year. So there is real progress in terms of the numbers, in terms of the geography. The vast majority of these countries now have been Ebola-freed, most districts or prefectures, for more than 42 days. Even the whole forest area now and the tri-country area where this all began are well over 42 days and nearly 3 months now since the virus has been found in those areas.
That's Dr. Bruce Aylward, the World Health Organization's Assistant Director General for Emergencies. He spoke today in Geneva. While the Ebola epidemic is still not over in Sierra Leone, cases have dwindled. Officials and humanitarian agencies say it's time to start rebuilding and strengthening the country's healthcare system. John Flaming is the emergency health coordinator for the International Federation of the Red Cross, Red Crescent Societies in Freetown. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the Ebola outbreak and what needs to be done to improve medical care in Sierra Leone.
As we are at the moment, a dramatic reduction in the number of cases, and these cases are in specific parts of the country, so it's no longer generalized. So we've got a number of cases here in Freetown and also in Port Loko and Cambia near the border with Guinea. So a small number of cases, and fortunately these cases have been proven relatively easy to trace back. There's still obviously no room and no time for complacency, but bearing in mind where we were back in December, January, there's been a dramatic and sustained drop in the number of cases here in Sierra Leone.
We're getting reports from Guinea this week of a spike in cases due to unsafe burials. There are reports that people are taking their dead relatives home in taxis or hiding them in cars so they can bury them in the traditional way. Is that a concern for you in Sierra Leone?
In the context of Sierra Leone, and indeed in the larger regional context, the unsafe burial of corpses is a huge driver arguably the biggest driver in the epidemic. Here in Sierra Leone, there's a very strict standard operating procedure, or SOP, in regards to the burial of corpses, not alone Ebola corpses, but anybody that dies here in Sierra Leone. There is the assumption, until proven negative by a swab, that that person has died of Ebola. Consequently, all deaths in Sierra Leone are carried out in a safe and dignified manner. But clearly, there is an important aspect here, and that is the engagement at the community level to ensure that communities are aware of the risk. So social mobilization, be it on the radio, be it door-to-door, be it posters, and by other means, to reinforce the messaging around safe and dignified burials.
14 months into the Ebola crisis, what is the status of the healthcare system?
Clearly, it was a healthcare system that was very stretched before the Ebola crisis. I speak for Sierra Leone, but I'm sure the same conditions apply in Guinea and Liberia. Obviously now, with a very stretched healthcare system prior to Ebola, it's been significantly reduced in terms of capacity as a result of Ebola. In Sierra Leone, for instance, there was a rather dramatic and sustained cholera outbreak in 2012 that had a dramatic effect. And of course, apart from Ebola, there are many, many illnesses within the region and within Sierra Leone that warrant attention. For instance, Sierra Leone has one of the highest rates of infant and maternal mortality in the world, with a maternal mortality rate of 1,165 per 100,000 live births. So apart from high maternal mortality, we've got measles, cholera, as I indicated, diarrheal disease, malaria, Lassa fever. So there are dramatic threats in terms of even taking Ebola out of the equation. There were dramatic and sustained outbreaks of other illnesses here. So as the term is, health system strengthening is extremely important, as is rolling out and supporting immunization campaigns to make sure that children and adults that may have defaulted or may not have been able to have access to immunization. And in immunization, I'm talking in the current context in regards to measles and polio. So it's extremely important to emphasize that whilst Ebola has been a tragic and sustained epidemic, there are other clearly present and dangerous threats as well from a public health perspective. And the Red Cross and other organizations are very well aware of this and are assisting the Ministry of Health and Sanitation, WHO, UNICEF, and others in social mobilization activities to promote the importance of immunization and people and families bringing their children for vaccination, particularly, as I said, for polio and for measles.
Now, I understand the immunization campaign gets underway May 29th.
The dates have been slightly changed, the 5th to the 10th of June. So as Red Cross, we've got what we call sound trucks that are traveling from community to community with jingles, if you like, that have been designed to actually get the messages in the local languages to as many communities as possible, and handing out pamphlets to explain to families the importance, the vital importance of bringing their children for vaccination during the course of this campaign.
Now, many Sierra Leone healthcare workers lost their lives to Ebola. How does the country bounce back from a loss like that?
It's extremely difficult, of course, but what is needed now is more focus on training, more focus on what's called infection prevention and control, to put in place systems that give confidence to healthcare workers whilst they're working in the facilities, that they're working within a safe environment, putting in place now systems that will allow for the early detection of Ebola, but also protection within the facilities to give medical staff that added confidence that when they go back to work in these facilities, that they have a significantly reduced risk of being infected.
John Fleming is the Emergency Health Coordinator for the International Federation of the Red Cross, Red Crescent Societies in Freetown. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua. The United Nations Children's Fund reports a sharp spike in the number of suicide attacks by children in northeast Nigeria. UNICEF says Boko Haram militants increasingly are using women and girls as suicide bombers of choice. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
For years, Nigerian militant group Boko Haram has used suicide bombers to attack public places, such as markets and transportation hubs. But in the past 18 months, the practice has taken an especially alarming turn with the increased use of women and children to carry out the deadly attacks. The agency has recorded 27 suicide attacks through mid-May of this year and an additional 26 attacks during 2014. UNICEF Child Protection Specialist Laurent Dutordois says women and children reportedly were used as suicide bombers in at least three quarters of these horrific incidents.
Sometimes they are aware, sometimes unknowingly. As for the profile of the child suicide bombers, it is not necessarily children who were abducted. It also includes children who seemingly were displaced, separated from their families, and lacking basic protection, which rendered them vulnerable to exploitation, meaning to use by armed groups.
UNICEF estimates the number of unaccompanied and separated children in northeastern Nigeria could be as high as 10,000. The United Nations says more than 1.3 million Nigerians have been displaced by the vicious war Boko Haram has waged in the northeast since 2009. Dutordois says women and girls are increasingly being used as suicide bombers because for cultural reasons, it is easier for them to slip through security than is the case with men and boys. Since July 2014, he says girls between the ages of 7 and 17 have been involved in 9 suicide incidents.
The main target of the suicide attacks have been crowded, populated places, mainly markets and bus stations. And some of those locations have been attacked multiple times. In the past, also schools have been subjects of suicide attacks.
UNICEF says it fears the increasing use of children as suicide bombers could make them be seen as potential threats rather than as victims. It says this could harden hearts against all children associated with Boko Haram and hamper their rehabilitation and eventual reintegration into communities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Eighteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. One police officer was killed in the latest act of violence by Al-Shabaab militants in Kenya. And UNICEF says Boko Haram militants increasingly are using women and girls as suicide bombers of choice. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. One UN peacekeeper was killed and one wounded when gunmen opened fire on their car in Mali's capital, Bamako, yesterday. Attacks on UN personnel in Mali have increased as security deteriorates in the north, where peace talks with Tuareg rebels have stalled. This week, Mali's government and the Tuareg Rebel Alliance meet again in Algiers. Katerina Hoya reports from Bamako.
The peacekeepers, part of Bangladesh's UN contingent, were driving from the airport along Bamako's back streets when unidentified gunmen opened fire on the car. A Bangladeshi army spokesman says one peacekeeper died on the scene while the other was rushed to the hospital. It was the second attack within a week on UN peacekeepers in Bamako. 5 days earlier, a gunman attacked a UN residence in the city's Fasukano neighborhood. With more than 40 peacekeepers killed and more than 100 wounded, Mali is fast becoming home to the world's deadliest peacekeeping mission. Taxi driver Mahamadou Koulibaly says he's not surprised the United Nations force is being targeted. He says, this is a Malian problem, and Malians should solve it. The UN is not the solution. They come here to do their business and not necessarily with Mali's best interest in mind. He says he strongly condemns the attack, but he's not surprised it happened. While attacks in the capital are rare, militants in the north regularly target UN personnel. The area has seen an upsurge in attacks by pro-government militias and Tuareg rebels fighting for political influence and for control over land and trade routes. Islamist militants have also stayed active in the region since a French-led military force ousted them from power in the region in 2013. Amid the violence, the north has again descended into the messy clannish squabble mediators and international organizations feared when the United Nations launched its mission in Mali 2 years ago. The government and northern armed groups signed a peace accord on May 15th during a ceremony in Bamako attended by several heads of state. But the main Tuareg rebel coalition, known as the Coalition for the Azawad Movements, CMA, failed to sign the agreement, saying it did not meet the demands. This week, the CMA and authorities again meet in Algiers. While no group has claimed responsibility for the attacks on peacekeepers in Bamako, the violence comes at a time of strained relations between the government and the UN mission. Last week, Malian President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita questioned the UN's impartiality, and the population, after years of unrest, is growing impatient for stability to return. Katrina Höje for VOA News, Bamako.
Kenyan officials say Al-Shabaab militants attacked a group of police officers late yesterday in the northeast of the country near the border with Somalia. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports one officer was killed in the latest act of violence in Kenya, blamed on the Somali-based Islamist group.
Kenyan police officials say one police officer was killed and at least four others were injured when suspected Al-Shabaab gunmen attacked a police patrol in the areas of Fafi and Yumbis in Garissa County. Interior Ministry spokesman Mwenda Njoka told VOA the attack began when a police vehicle hit a landmine.
So some other officers came to rescue. They both the vehicle and the officers were there. There was an ambush by the militants.
In the same county last month, the Islamist militants killed 148 people, mostly students, in a day-long assault on a local university. As recently as last week, Al-Shabaab members were reportedly preaching to local residents in the same village where Monday's attack took place.
It's more or less the same area that there have been some murmurs of the Al-Shabaab militants being fighting. It's within the same locality. It's very close to the Somali border.
Al-Shabaab claimed to have killed more than 20 police officers in the attack, as reported by local media. Speaking to VOA by phone Tuesday, Garissa County Commissioner James Kianda confirmed that one officer had died from injuries. He denied previous reports that any other officers were missing.
We do not have any officer who is missing. All the officers have been accounted for as we speak.
He said some vehicles were damaged in the incident and that police are pursuing the attackers. The Kenyan government has promised to boost security in the volatile northeastern region, particularly after the Garissa University College massacre. Interior spokesman Njoka said authorities have put more forces on the ground, but adds that improving security is a long-term project.
This kind of militants, they keep shifting, they keep moving, and the terrain also, as you might be aware, is a very hostile terrain there in terms of communication. So boosting security also involves also investing in infrastructure, which is not something that happens overnight.
Al-Shabaab has vowed to continue attacks across the border in retaliation for Kenya's military operations in southern Somalia. Kenya sent troops to Somalia 4 years ago to help the African Union combat Al-Shabaab. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The African Union, which sent the only foreign observer mission to Ethiopia's national elections, said yesterday's poll was credible. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Addis Ababa. The opposition has long accused the ruling party of creating an uneven playing field and intimidating and harassing critics.
Calm, peaceful, and credible. Those are three of the key words the African Union Election Observer Mission used to describe Ethiopia's national election, which is widely expected to produce yet another landslide win for the nation's longtime ruling party. But free and fair, two critical adjectives, were missing from the assessment by the only foreign election observer mission present as tens of millions of Ethiopians voted Sunday. Mission head Hifikepunye Pohamba is a former Namibian president.
The AU election observers mission concludes that the parliamentary elections were calm, peaceful, and credible, as it provided an opportunity for the Ethiopian people to express their choices at the polls.
Pahamba said the mission did not hear any reports of major violence or problems on Election Day, but he said observers saw ruling party allies openly urging voters inside the polling station and that some stations opened before the stipulated 6 a.m. start time. He added that the dark canvas ballot boxes in many stations were insufficiently transparent. When VOA asked if the election was fair, free, and transparent, AU observer Chika Charles Anyekwe did not answer directly.
We want to be guided by our pronouncement. We don't want to pronounce on what we have not seen. So our judgment of the election was that it was peaceful, it was calm, and credible. So we don't want to delve into what we have not pronounced.
This is the first vote since the 2012 death of Meles Zenawi, who had led the nation since 1991, first as president, then as prime minister. Mr. Meles' successor, former academic Hailemariam Desalegn, is widely expected to stay in charge as head of the ruling Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front. Mr. Meles encountered an electoral roadblock in 2005, when a swell of support for the opposition overflowed into street protests. Government security forces opened fire on opposition supporters who accused officials of vote rigging. A public inquiry determined that 200 people were killed. Tens of thousands of opposition leaders and supporters were jailed. The ruling party then won all but a single seat in parliament in the 2010 polls. The European Union observers criticized the ruling party for creating an unfair playing field for the opposition. Before this election, the opposition accused the government of hindering their campaigns through arrests, harassment, intimidation, and unequal access to funding. The government has denied the allegations. AU observer Chief Pahamba urged calm.
The OAU election observer mission encourages political parties, candidates, their supporters, and the electorate to maintain the prevailing atmosphere of peace that characterized pre-election and the election day, and the urge for the use of the legal channels of complaints and appeals should there be any post-electoral disputes.
Ethiopia's election board says it will soon release preliminary results. Final results are due June 22nd. Anita Powell, VOA News, Addis Ababa.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Yiswu-Hib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Time on Straight Talk Africa. Despite a failed coup attempt, Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza remains steadfast in his plans to run for a third term. Demonstrators say he has had his chance. Regional leaders want the June 26 election postponed until the nation is stable. Join us on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC for an in-depth discussion on Burundi. That's right here on VOA Africa.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Thank you.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. One police officer was killed in the latest act of violence by Al-Shabaab militants in Kenya. UNICEF says Boko Haram militants increasingly are using women and girls as suicide bombers of choice. And yesterday's national election in Ethiopia was credible, according to African Union observers. Coming up, music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, trying to find solutions for police brutality and ensuing racial tensions in an American city. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sonny is next. Time now for the sunny set of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Happy Tuesday, Yehias.
I understand you're kicking off with African football.
Yes, Yehias. Let's kick off with African football. The field is set for Thursday's semifinals at the 15th COSAFA Cup tournament in South Africa. In the first semifinal at the Moruleng Stadium in South Africa's Northwest Province, Namibia will meet Madagascar. And that will be followed by the second semifinal between Botswana and Mozambique. The Mozambicans advance to the Final Four by beating Malawi on penalty kicks after a 2-2 draw. Botswana also needed penalty kicks to oust host South Africa, as did Namibia, which eliminated defending champion Zambia. In a tournament of surprises, Madagascar pulled off perhaps the biggest upset, shocking guest team Ghana on Monday 2-1. With the score tied at 1-1, the match appeared to be going to another penalty kick shootout, but Madagascar got a spectacular goal in the last minute of the match from Olivier Somori. He hit the ball perfectly into the top corner of the net over Ghana's experienced goalkeeper, Fatou Dauda. I'll be talking with our African football guru, David Legg, about the COSAFA Cup during Wednesday's Sunny Side of Sports. I'm guessing David didn't have Madagascar and a few of those other teams advancing to the semifinals before the competition kicked off. In fact, the four teams in Thursday's semifinals, Namibia, Madagascar, Botswana, and Mozambique, have never lifted the COSAFA Cup for member nations of the Council of Southern Africa Football Associations.
Voice of America!
Cook all meat and animal products thoroughly before consumption. My name is John Obi Mikel. Together we can beat Ebola.
Chelsea midfielder John Obi Mikel has been omitted from Nigeria's squad for next month's 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier against Chad. Nigeria's head coach, Stephen Keshi, denies reports of a rift with Obi Mikel, saying, and I quote, "We've spoken, and contrary to reports, there is no problem between us at all." The Nations Cup qualifier against visiting Chad is scheduled for June 13th in Kaduna. Obi Mikel hasn't played for the Super Eagles of Nigeria since last November, but Keshi describes the Chelsea man as an integral member of the team who brings a lot to it. Keshi says right now he wants to give opportunities to some new players. One of the foreign-based players Keshi did include on his roster is Lille goalkeeper Vincent Enyema, who David Legg has described as the best goalkeeper in Africa.
Enyema is one of 15 foreign-based players who are scheduled to join locally-based players at a training camp in Abuja next week ahead of the Chad match. Keshi led the Super Eagles to the 2013 Nations Cup title, but the Nigerians failed to qualify for this year's tournament in Equatorial Guinea, which was won by Ivory Coast. Keshi says he has a big task ahead to rebuild the team, and he's confident Nigeria will bounce back. Oh, Africa,
this is Africa. Samina, mina, waka, waka, Samina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited. Ni chabulile.
Hola. Cause this is Africa. Samina, mina, waka, waka, Samina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. I received a nice letter today from Ezekiel Caring, who writes from Moyes Bridge in Kenya's Rift Valley province. Ezekiel says he wants to give a shout-out for Voice of America director David Ensor, who is stepping down at the end of May. In fact, Ezekiel's letter arrived one day before a celebration at our VOA headquarters for director Ensor. Ezekiel, I'll pass on your comments to David, and thanks for writing. Turning to African athletics, Kenya-born Eunice Chumba finished third among the women at the recent Karlovy Vary half marathon in the Czech Republic. Eunice, who now runs for Bahrain, had a time of 70 minutes and 59 seconds. That put her 1 minute and 48 seconds behind the winner, Mulu Saboka of Ethiopia, and 32 seconds behind the second-place finisher, Lina Chirutu of Kenya. The energetic Andy Edwards spoke with Eunice Chumba before the race. Here's Andy.
We're going to have a chat with Eunice Chumba, who is Kenyan-born, but for the last year or so has been running for Bahrain and with great success. Eunice, I know Kenyans travel a lot, and of course you're Bahraini as an athlete now, but you are really getting around the place. Because not only are you here in the Czech Republic, in Karlovy Vary, but you've been running in the Asian Games and looking at the Asian Championships. So you're only 21. First of all, what prompted the switch from being a Kenyan to running for Bahrain?
It was an opportunity. Now, in Kenya, we have so many runners in Kenya, and most are the best. But now I decided only to go to run for Bahrain. Yeah.
And you train back in Iten in Kenya, of course, one of the hotbeds of training. Your running partners, do they show any resentment, animosity to you, or do they just say, good luck to you?
No, they say, yes, good luck to you. Maybe even my friends say, yeah, you take us even there. We can run for Bahrain. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. You were telling me before we began recording this interview that you're still running track, 10,000 metres. You've run 32 minutes, 40-odd last year in the Asian Games. And you're looking at the Asian Championships coming up. Now, what's the significance of those Asian Championships?
Now, I'm going back to Kenya to prepare for Asian Championship. Now, nothing. I have been training for this half marathon and also for track, no problem.
You don't find a problem combining road race training and 10,000 meter track training?
No problem at all. I have been training for part of them. Yeah, if I have no race in for track, I usually go for road races.
And the reason for those Asian championships coming up in China in June is because, from what I understand, the Bahraini Federation will then select their world championship team for Beijing in August. And, of course, I presume you want to be running in the 10,000 meters in Beijing.
Yeah, I am looking forward now to run the 10,000 in world championship in Beijing. Now, for June is like selecting the team. So to represent Bahrain in China. Now I'm looking forward to be the top three so that I can compete here.
Well, that certainly will be fascinating. You're only 21, so you've packed a lot into your life. I mean, all these decisions saying I'm going to run for Bahrain, travelling around, going to Asian championships. Is it you who's making those decisions or do you have advisors?
No, it is my no advisors. It is like my private schedule.
Well, may I say you've got a wise head on what are very young shoulders at the age of 21 and very promising as an athlete. Well, Eunice Chumba, all the best for those Asian Championships qualifiers. We will look forward to seeing you on the track running for Bahrain. Thanks very much, Eunice.
Okay, thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
In the National Basketball Association playoffs Monday night, the Houston Rockets avoided elimination with a 128-115 victory over the visiting Golden State Warriors. It was must-win for the Rockets, who now trail the best-of-seven-game Western Conference Finals 3-1. Rockets star James Harden, who sports my favorite beard in basketball, exploded for a playoff career-high 45 points. Houston led from start to finish, and the Rockets now travel to Oakland, California, where Game 5 will be played Wednesday night. The Warriors advance to the NBA Finals if they win on Wednesday night. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yeheyas Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, trying to find solutions for police brutality and the ensuing racial tensions in an American city. And next, South Sudan's deteriorating economy. But first, some music. Here is Roki Duwani of Ghana with Download the Revolution.
There comes a time when the table must turn.
Yeah, this one goes to those who thought this day would never, never, never come.
Music is a revolution. Catch this fire.
Revolution.
I want all my brothers and my sisters to say, yeah.
This conscious music revolution.
Yeah, take a stand. All you have to say is, yeah.
Download this revolution.
I want all my brothers and my sisters to say, yeah.
A rebel music stirring up commotion.
Yeah, take a stand. All you have to say is, yeah.
Blaze with it. Babylon newspaper will not mention it.
For so long they tried to keep us back, yeah. Peer to peer, soul to soul, here we come. Download this revolution.
I want all my brothers and my sisters to say, yeah.
This conscious music revolution.
Yeah, so take a stand, all you have to say is, to say, yeah.
To wipe away the musical pollution.
Yeah, take a step. Oh. All you have to say is, yeah.
Download this, download this, download this revolution. Upload this, download this, download this revolution. The playing field keeps leveling. Every door them shutting keep on opening. To run this nation, yet peer to peer, soul to soul, heart to heart. Download the revolution.
I want all my brothers and my sisters to say, yeah.
This conscious music revolution.
Yeah, take a step. All you have to say is, yeah.
Download this revolution.
I want all my brothers and my sisters to say, yeah.
Your conscious music revolution.
Get up and take a stand. All you have to say is, yeah.
In Ghana,
download this.
In America,
download this.
In Jamaica,
download this.
The whole of world,
download this.
For those who've been scorned, a new battle to be won, a new day has dawned. The old ways are gone, a new day has come, yeah. Download this, upload this, a revolution. Download this, upload this, a revolution. Download this, upload this, a revolution.
Rocky Duwani of Ghana would download the revolution. Officials in Baltimore, Maryland estimate recent riots against local police cost $9 million in damages. Angry residents took to the streets in the predominantly African-American city after the suspicious death of Freddie Gray, a black man, while he was in police custody. Six police officers, including three African-Americans, now face criminal charges in connection with the death. VOA's Chris Simpkins reports residents are looking towards the future and solutions to uplift the entire city.
Life has returned to normal in this riot-torn West Baltimore neighborhood. Police are still fighting high crime, and on nearly every corner are signs of economic despair. The recent riots only compounded the problem. More than 280 businesses were damaged in the area, where 23% of black men are unemployed. University of Maryland School of Social Work Assistant Dean Bronwyn Maiden was born in Baltimore and says securing jobs for blacks is key to the city's future success.
But we also need people that are ready to be trained for jobs. And right now in this community, we have a lot of issues where we need to work on getting people ready to be able to hold jobs.
Maryland state lawmaker Antonio Hayes, who represents this neighborhood, says people here want a better Baltimore.
Being better means seeing justice in our criminal justice system, having better opportunities for fair housing, you know, having better wages.
One out of four blacks in this neighborhood do not have a high school diploma. Brittany Davis blames city officials, including Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, for not making educational investments in black neighborhoods.
She's taken away from money from
our taxpayers' money, giving it to a builder downtown to build condos, but our schools are lacking the resources that they need for our children.
You know, but it's a conversation that got to be had.
Community leaders say regaining trust with the police is also essential to moving the city forward. Former Baltimore police officer Rob Weinhold.
You have to be engaged with the folks that you are sworn to protect and serve, understanding what the core issues are so you can, as a public servant, figure out how to be a terrific convener, facilitator, and problem solver to improve the quality of life.
Linda Keyes wants the police to do more to fight crime in the neighborhood and dreams of a better quality of life for her family.
I hope they really build the community up like they say they will. And with that being said, I'll do anything in my power to help. I have no problem with going out there door to door and asking anybody, do they want to help?
Keyes and others believe positive change can happen with a stronger determination to invest more money in the community and the people who live here. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Baltimore.
South Sudan's deteriorating economy has caused big increases in the cost of food and medicine. In the state of Wau, some people can no longer afford life-saving medicine for their children. Michael Atit has the story from Wau.
Raquel Etom-Rabe is the mother of three boys. Last week, when her younger son was diagnosed with malaria, she took him to a pharmacy in Wau to buy a treatment. But when she got to the pharmacy, she was astonished to find out that the price of one course of malaria treatment for children cost 35 South Sudanese pounds, nearly twice as much as it did 2 months ago. Raquel says medicine's prices these days are a big problem. You might have 20 South Sudanese pounds, but you cannot afford to buy a medicine for your child. She said her son is sick with malaria, and she does not have enough money to buy the medicine he needs. Filberto Tibur has run this pharmacy in Wau for more than 3 years. He says many of the drugs he sells are brought into South Sudan from neighboring countries like Uganda, Kenya, and Sudan. Tibur says not only have these expenses gone up, but the rains and the poor roads make it difficult for pharmacies to obtain enough drugs to meet customers' demand. He says he is worried that he might run out of some basic drugs.
The drug which is in the store, when it's got finished, we do not know where we have to go because the road is terrible. And as the stores who are in Juba, the rate now has gone higher. And to hire a vehicle from Juba and then you take all your load up to Wau here, you get a lot of taxation on the road.
Abazar Abu Zaid buys wholesale medicine from supplies in Khartoum and sells them in Wau. He says the border conflict between Sudan and South Sudan and unfavorable exchange rates for hard currency are making it difficult to buy drugs. Abu Zaid says it takes many days for the delivery trucks to reach Wau, and they have to pay a lot of tax at the various checkpoints along the road from Sudan to South Sudan. Abu Zaid says when there is a conflict on the border between the two countries, their truck that carry drugs will be detained somewhere and sometime it gets spoiled on the way. During this rainy season, he says, they cannot provide as much as they could during the summer. So they raise the prices due to the situation of the market. Isaac Cleto Real is the Western Bahr El Ghazal State Minister of Health. He admits South Sudan's ailing economy is affecting the cost of the medicines. Rial says his ministry is working hard to provide drugs that people need to treat common diseases like malaria.
So yes, there will be a rise. It's happening in all the commodities that is happening. But we put it very clear. In case of emergencies, we as government avail the emergency drug. The life-saving drugs must be availed and close and attend to the patients. The other drugs that come, especially when they come for the season of malaria and other diseases of the rainy season, the stores that we have will be overwhelmed by the number of patients that come.
As South Sudan's economy declines, prices for just about everything are rising sharply. Experts cite a number of reasons, including that government coffers are nearly empty because oil exports, which are the backbone of the economy, have fallen by around half since the country erupted in violence in December 2013. They also note that exchange rate for U.S. dollars has risen by around 300%, making it difficult for South Sudanese to buy dollars to pay for imports. Then, there is a poor infrastructure in South Sudan, which makes it difficult to get the few goods that merchants can buy into the shops and market stalls in South Sudan where people buy them. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit reporting in WOW.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political separatists have signed a preliminary peace agreement with the government of Mali, a hopeful step towards ending decades of fighting in the troubled West African nation. The deal, mediated by the United Nations and the government of Algeria, was accepted in preliminary form by the government on May 14th. A coalition of separatist groups seeking more autonomy for areas in northern Mali, which they call Azawad, have agreed to the deal in principle. They will press for more guarantees on their demands, however, before signing a final accord. Meanwhile, sporadic fighting continues. Rebel leader Bilal Ag-Sharif says the separatists are committed to peace. "We have agreed on many issues, but there are certain issues pending before a final agreement with the government," he told reporters in Algiers. Separatists have rebelled four times since Mali's independence from France in 1960. In 2012, they formed an alliance with Islamist militants to seize the desert north. A French-led military intervention scattered the insurgents, though isolated attacks continue. The United States welcomes the formal commitments taken to advance lasting peace and reconciliation in Mali. "We urge all Malian parties to sign the accord, to underscore their concrete commitment to peace, and to continue to engage constructively to implement it. We commend the government of Mali for its commitment to the peace process and its openness to dialogue. We also thank the government of Algeria for the leading mediation role it has played in the peace process. We are deeply concerned by ongoing reports of fighting, however, and we call on all parties to respect the existing ceasefire agreements and commit to resolving differences through dialogue. The United States remains committed to helping the Malian people as they work to achieve a durable peace. We reiterate our support for the UN Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Mali for its efforts to assist the Malian people to consolidate peace."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa,
Despite a failed coup attempt, Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza remains steadfast in his plans to run for a third term. Demonstrators say he has had his chance. Regional leaders want the June 26 election postponed until the nation is stable. Join us on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC for an in-depth discussion on Burundi. That's right here on VOA Africa.